to recover his $2.5 million donation, citing, quote, disappointing results in these lawsuits. Do you think there might be other such lawsuits, and do they have any chance of winning?
Yeah, so that lawsuit actually pertains to a separate group, True the Vote, which also took money from Eshelman, or which took money from Eshelman with promises to try and overturn the election results, and of course failed. I think a distinction between where a lot of the money is coming from for Trump's leadership PAC and Eshelman is that a lot of the money for Trump is coming from small donors, from people who may not have the resources to sue Trump or to really even identify that their money is being misused. I think that's part of what's unique about this, because typically candidates have an incentive to maintain a level of trust with their supporters. They might use inflammatory fundraising appeals, but they want maintain a level of trust so people keep giving. Of course, Trump is the person who said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and still maintain a level of support. And this post-election fundraising might just be the political version of that.
We want to thank you, Brendan Fischer, Director of Federal Reform at Campaign Legal Center. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31st, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers pass $800 million in COVID-19 relief during Monday's special session. A new report shows a record number of houseless people died in Multnomah County in 2019. And Alex Padilla has been selected to replace Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, becoming the first Latino senator to represent California. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 22nd, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon legislature approved a list of bills for COVID-19 relief during a special session on Monday. Lawmakers passed $800 million in legislation that is aimed at keeping Oregonians housed while helping landlords and struggling businesses. The bills passed include a six-month extension of Oregon's residential eviction moratorium, as well as a go-ahead for to-go cocktails. Restaurants and bars will now be able to start selling to-go cocktails and single servings of wine. The bill, effective on passage, expires 60 days after Governor Kate Brown's COVID-19 state of emergency is no longer in effect. Lawmakers also placed a cap on the fees that third-party delivery apps can charge dining establishments in an attempt to aid restaurants who have switched to takeout and delivery due to restrictions on indoor dining. To help keep Oregonians housed during the pandemic, legislators also passed a six-month extension of Oregon's residential eviction moratorium. The new eviction ban is slightly more detailed than the current moratorium. The new policy only applies to renters who send their landlord a so-called declaration of financial hardship, explaining how the pandemic and/or wildfires have impacted their ability to pay rent. The new eviction ban will last until the end of June. Tenants will still be required to repay all missed rent by July 1, 2021. Lawmakers also dedicated $50 million to rental relief and set aside $150 million to pay landlords up to 80% of what they are owed by struggling renters. Landlords who accept the payments must forgive the other 20%. Just hours after lawmakers passed the eviction ban extension, three landlords sued to invalidate the moratorium, arguing that it is unconstitutional because it hinders legal contracts and amounts to the government taking their property without proper compensation. The suit names Governor Kate Brown, Multnomah County, the City of Portland, and the State of Oregon as defendants. State leaders and tenant advocates have warned that resuming evictions would lead to a wave of homelessness during a global pandemic. The Oregon Health Authority reported 846 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 103,755. Oregon health officials also reported six new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,347. Multnomah County had the highest number of cases on Monday, with 212, followed by Clackamas County with 114 and Washington County with 108. There are currently 528 people hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide, with 121 coronavirus patients in the intensive care unit. Nationally, as of Tuesday afternoon, the U.S. has reported at least 18.1 million cases of COVID-19. More than 321,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 216,000 cases per day, an increase of 7% from the average 2 weeks earlier. In addition, hospitalizations in the U.S. are over 115,000 for the first time, with one-fifth of hospitals reporting that at least 95% of their ICU beds were full. Roughly 6 million doses of the newly authorized Moderna vaccine are being shipped to more than 3,700 locations around the country this week. This is in addition to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which began being administered last week. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so far, more than 600,000 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have already been administered. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 77.7 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.7 million people have died across the world. This year's annual report on Multnomah County deaths of houseless people tallied the highest number of lives lost in a single year since tracking began 9 years ago. The report, called Domicile Unknown, is a joint effort between Multnomah County and the advocacy group Street Roots to better inform elected officials and the public on the importance of housing as a human right and the impact of houselessness on members of our community. According to this year's publication of Domicile Unknown, in the 2019 calendar year, at least 113 people died while houseless. This number is significantly higher than the 92 lives lost the year before, which was the previous record. Of those who died in 2019, over half were found outside, and 4 died from hypothermia. The publication intertwines personal stories of those who were lost with analysis and data provided by the Multnomah County Medical Examiner. One key theme throughout the report is the largely preventable nature of most of these deaths. In a press conference Monday, County Deputy Health Director Paul Lewis said, quote, "Housing is health, and I think this report, unfortunately, for the 9th time in a row, illustrates that." Over half of the deaths were accidental, some due to drugs such as methamphetamine or alcohol, and some due to traumatic accidents such as getting hit by a car or a train. Many people died due in part to chronic health complications such as uncontrolled diabetes and heart disease. Since reporting began less than 10 years ago, the number of deaths on Multnomah County streets has more than doubled from 47 in 2011 to 113 last year. While the report does not go into detail about why these numbers have increased so quickly, county representatives suggested rising rents and increased rates of houselessness were to blame. The report's release coincided with the winter solstice, which is the darkest day of the year, and recognized as National Homeless Persons Memorial Day. Speaking to the importance of the report, Executive Director of Street Roots, Kaya Sand, said, quote, "This report is foundational for our advocacy efforts because it really is clear what's at stake. The difference between housing and homelessness is the difference between life and death." Airport workers are feeling vulnerable to COVID-19, saying safety measures need to be more strictly enforced. Workers also would like to know if their coworkers have tested positive for the virus. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Essential workers are feeling the pressure of the holidays during the pandemic. With an uptick in travel coming, airport workers are feeling especially vulnerable. Salam Andarji is a cabin cleaner at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport and a member of Service Employees International Union Local 6. She's concerned that there aren't more safety measures in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19, such as when she travels to the plane with her co-workers.
It's not big fun, so we sit like 8 people, 9 people together, so there's no 6 feet between us.
Perry Cooper with the Port of Seattle says the airport doesn't directly hire or supervise workers such as Andarji, but he notes the airport has a mask policy and has helped companies fill in gaps to improve safety. Cooper says SeaTac has worked with SEIU to provide face shields for workers during transportation. Andarji did not reveal the name of her employer out of concern for her job. Andarji has another concern about her employer's disclosure of people who have the virus. Andarji says one of her co-workers called to tell her he had tested positive for COVID-19 and to be aware that some of her colleagues probably had been exposed as well.
The company didn't tell us, and then the company didn't tell them to quarantine or like get tested for COVID-19.
Cooper says the issue with disclosing who has tested positive for coronavirus is health privacy laws. Still, Andarji is frustrated with the way her employer has treated workers during the pandemic.
The company have to see us like as a human being, you know? We risk our life to work.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Advocates for people living with disabilities are urging them to be aware of the possible risks from COVID-19. Andrea Sears has more on the story with the Public News Service.
With coronavirus vaccines now being distributed, advocates for people living with disabilities are stressing the importance of knowing if they are at increased risk of COVID-19. People with certain disabilities or on medications with particular side effects are more vulnerable to the effects of the virus, and people in nursing homes or group housing are more likely to become infected. These and other considerations will determine the priorities for vaccine distribution. Susan Dua with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has information online about who is at greatest risk.
There's a whole list of chronic or serious health conditions that would put them in the higher risk category, that puts them higher up to receive vaccination.
Information about COVID-19 vaccines and conditions that put people at increased risk from the coronavirus can be found on the CDC website at cdc.gov. Dua cautions that some people with specific health conditions may be advised not to get the vaccinations currently available, so it's important to find out if they could be at risk of an adverse reaction.
People should speak with their own health practitioner and ask, based on their own health status and the medications they're taking, whether the vaccine is right for them at present.
Conditions that warrant consulting a healthcare provider include allergic reactions to any of the ingredients of the COVID vaccine or to other vaccines. Dua points out that people living in nursing homes or other care facilities in New York can get help if their facilities fail to provide adequate information or explanations of vaccine risks and protocols.
You can call the New York Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program if you believe perhaps that your right to be educated and to consent freely is being violated.
Listings of long-term care ombudsmen by county are available through the New York Office for the Aging website at aging.ny.gov. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Former Department of Health data manager Rebecca Jones has filed a lawsuit against the Florida Department of Law Enforcement over a search warrant that was executed at her home. Jones and her attorneys claim the raid was a sham designed to intimidate her and other fellow whistleblowers. Tramell Gomes has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Former state data analyst Rebecca Jones is fighting back against the administration of Governor Ron DeSantis, this time through a lawsuit. In a complaint filed Monday, Jones claims Florida state police officers violated her constitutional rights when they raided her home with guns drawn the morning of December 7th. Jones was fired in May for failing to change data on the state's coronavirus dashboard that she created. Jones's attorney, Rick Johnson of Tallahassee, says he's asking the court to order the return of all the equipment seized in the raid and for the state to pay legal fees and punitive damages from the ordeal.
Her jump drives and disk drives and even an external hard drive. And so we want that back. And another thing is that they did some harm and we want them to pay for it.
The state claims it had probable cause to execute the search warrant, saying a computer at Jones's home was used to hack the Department of Health, urging employees to speak out. FDLE Commissioner Rick Swearingen has defended the agent's actions, saying no guns were pointed at any individuals. Johnson believes the aggressive tactics were orchestrated, designed by the DeSantis administration as both a fact-finding mission and to send a message.
To find out who all her confidential sources are. And those people are in horror. They're terrified. They want to know whether there's going to be 8 or 9 FDLE agents pounding on their door and terrorizing their family with guns.
Governor DeSantis recently argued with reporters saying the search warrant execution shouldn't be called a raid. He said Jones was fired because she wasn't doing a good job, adding, obviously, she's got issues. After Jones's dismissal earlier this year, she became a whistleblower. For Florida News Connection, I'm Tramell Gomes.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at addiction care during the holiday season. Then at 6, it's preference. And at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 48 degrees. Today in history, in 1808, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony premieres in Vienna, Austria. It's now recognized as one of the greatest pieces of music ever written. The Fifth Symphony quickly became a centerpiece of the classical repertoire for orchestras around the world. The quote of the day is from American writer and activist James Baldwin, who said, quote, "It is certain, in any case, that ignorance, allied with power, is the most ferocious enemy justice can have." California Governor Gavin Newsom has made a historic pick to fill the Senate seat of Kamala Harris. For more, we go to KABU's Al Kahn.
California Governor Gavin Newsom announced today that he has selected Alex Padilla to fill a Senate seat vacated by Kamala Harris as she becomes Vice President. Padilla is the current California Secretary of State, holding the position since 2014. after serving in the California State Senate, representing the state's 20th district, which includes Los Angeles and San Bernardino counties. Newsom's pick makes Padilla the first Latino to represent the state of California in the U.S. Senate in history. This is significant in a state where Latinos comprise 40% of the total population. Padilla, the son of Mexican immigrants, graduated from Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1994 with a degree in engineering and then worked briefly for Hughes Aircraft writing software for satellite systems. Entering politics in 1995, he served as personal assistant to State Senator Dianne Feinstein, followed by acting as campaign manager for three separate assemblymen in the next 3 years, all of which campaigns were victorious. After announcing his decision, Governor Nuñez tweeted, quote, "The Alex Padilla I know is far more interested in changing history, especially for the working men and women of our state and country. I can think of no better person to represent the state of California as our next United States Senator," end quote. In the past week since the election, Newsom has been pushed by various groups on who to select. Progressives have lobbied for Representative Barbara Lee or another progressive, while others pressured him to replace Harris with another black woman, such as Lee or Representative Karen Bass. For KBU News, I'm Al Khan.
The Postal Service is under pressure to deliver packages before Christmas. KBOO's Al Khan has more.
As COVID numbers continue to rise, many people have turned to online shopping over malls and the bigger stores. This, plus the shortage of workers, has had a harsh impact on the U.S. Postal Service. The Postal Service has already been under attack this year as Postmaster General Louis DeJoy removed shorting machines and cut overtime pay to workers in order to cut costs. But now, with the mounting pressure of the Christmas rush, many fear that packages may not arrive at their destinations before the holiday. The post office as a public service does not have the luxury of private carriers such as Federal Express and UPS to limit the volume of packages that they accept, and is being tasked with shipping an estimated extra 600 packages a day. Many postal workers have been working through weekends, and some have been handed work weeks of up to 80 hours, attempting to process all the extra packages that the system has been receiving. And it has also been reported that in some locations, truck drivers have been waiting up to 48 hours to unload packages that are stacking up in workspaces, leaving only narrow aisles to allow workers to move around the shop floors. According to the Postal Workers Union, close to 19,000 workers are not at their jobs due to illness or are in isolation due to COVID exposure, which only adds to the workload on those able to be at their jobs. For KBU News, I'm Al Khan.
Congress passes a stimulus package before the midnight deadline. Ivanka Trump and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris are both in Georgia campaigning for Senate runoff candidates, and President-elect Joe Biden was vaccinated on live television. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow-Tellum with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory. The Senate and House passed a $900 billion pandemic relief package Monday night. It includes $600 stimulus payments to millions of American adults and revives additional federal unemployment benefits, this time at $300 a week for 11 weeks. A big part of the package is for the Paycheck Protection Program, which supports small businesses, as well as resources for vaccine distribution and aid for schools. While President-elect Joe Biden wasn't directly involved, Democratic congressional staffers were in close contact with Biden's team during negotiations. Meanwhile, the GOP sent Ms. Trump to campaign in Georgia.
"We must send David and Kelly back to the Senate to defend election integrity and protect American democracy. And fight for Trump."
Ivanka Trump's remarks come the same day her father's appointee, Attorney General William Barr, shot down the president's most recent proposal to appoint a special counsel to further investigate baseless claims of election fraud, as well as take over the investigation into Hunter Biden's finances. Barr steps down tomorrow. Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler hosted the first daughter at a rally to support their efforts to retain their seats in the state's special January 5th elections.
"This is the most important congressional runoff in our nation's history. Georgia will decide which party controls the United States Senate."
Both senators supported Texas's Supreme Court lawsuit that tried and failed to overturn the election in battleground states like Georgia. The latest polling shows Perdue with a 2-point lead among likely voters and Loeffler ahead by 6 points. But a coalition of African American pastors in Georgia are criticizing Loeffler. In an open letter, they argue that she's crossed the line by calling the Reverend Dr. Warnock a radical liberal, using an excerpt from an old church sermon scrutinizing police officers. They think it's an attack on the black church. Senator Loeffler used the line 13 times in a recent debate. The Democratic challengers are also getting support from the Biden campaign. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris was there campaigning for the Reverend and Senate candidate John Ossoff. In streamed audio from Columbus, Harris invoked some holiday sentiment.
In the spirit of the celebration of a birth that taught us that it is within the power of an individual to leave this world better than we found it, let us use these days leading up to January 5th to make sure everyone we know understands their power, that they understand what is at stake.
Back in Delaware, Biden got vaccinated on live television Monday. As reporters snapped photos, Biden got the first of two vaccine shots at Christiana Hospital in Newark.
I'm doing this to demonstrate that people should be prepared when it's available to take the vaccine.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Tribal water rights are included in the most recent spending bill. The Coquille tribe will open a health clinic in Eugene, and the Hopi tribe begins COVID-19 vaccinations. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo-Utah Water Rights Settlement Act is included in the government spending bill passed by Congress overnight. The measure settles all current and future claims by the Navajo Nation for water rights in Utah. It confirms the tribe's right to water in the Colorado River Basin and authorizes about $220 million for water projects to provide clean drinking water to Navajo communities in the state. More than 40% of Navajo households in Utah are said to lack running water or adequate sanitation. Montana tribal water rights are also included in the bill. The Montana Water Rights Protection Act will have an impact on the Flathead Reservation. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes will be able to rehabilitate and modernize an irrigation project and restore damage to fish and wildlife habitat caused by the project. It will also protect farmers and ranchers who depend on irrigation. The bill will restore the National Bison Range back to tribal ownership. In addition, the spending package includes a number of provisions for tribes across the country for COVID-19 aid, funding for language programs and education, and funding for NAGPRA enforcement. The spending package was approved Monday night and sent to the president to sign. The Coquille Indian tribe based in Oregon is opening an outpatient medical clinic in the city of Eugene, more than 100 miles away from its tribal headquarters. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the clinic is intended to expand healthcare access for American Indian and Alaska Native people.
The tribe's already developing a wellness center in Coos Bay, but citing the potlatch tradition of sharing resources, Coquille officials say they're starting a new one in Eugene, where an estimated 6,000 Indigenous people live. The Coquille tribe's executive director, Mark Johnston, says the clinic will start in earnest before expanding to full services in April.
We will initially begin providing flu shot clinics and some COVID testing here by the end of the month. Our special message to all the American Indian Alaska Natives that live in Lane County and even outside of Lane County that we're looking forward to serving them and that we'll be open as soon as we can for them.
The new clinic will incorporate culturally sensitive elements in both its design and application of health and medicine. It'll be based in the North Eugene, Santa Clara area next to an existing dental clinic and physical therapy center. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Some tribal communities in the Southwest have received the first shipments of COVID-19 vaccines. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports on the Hopi Reservation in northeastern Arizona, health workers and first responders were among those to get shots.
About 150 doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine were administered at the Hopi Healthcare Center last week. Tribal officials expect 400 more doses of the newly approved Moderna treatment in the coming days. The 9,000-person tribe is in the midst of a major surge in new cases. As of late last week, Hopi health officials had reported 125 people who've tested positive or developed symptoms in the last 14 days. New new infections are nearing the record numbers seen on the reservation during a summer spike. Hopi leaders say the coronavirus is widespread throughout the 12 Hopi villages and worry sick patients could soon overwhelm the limited capacity of local health care facilities. Southwestern tribes have experienced disproportionate levels of infections and deaths during the pandemic, with case rates often greater than national and state averages. COVID cases throughout Arizona have spiked in the last month and a half, with hospitalizations at record highs and limited availability of beds. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
When customers reduce demand for electricity, utilities can avoid turning on polluting backup power plants. In this way, energy efficiency can help make the electric grid cleaner. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you improve your home's energy efficiency by adding insulation or installing a new heating system, it can lower your bills and make your home more comfortable. These changes can also help reduce stress on the electric grid at times of peak energy use. Natalie Mems Frick of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory analyzed energy efficiency programs offered by publicly owned utilities in 9 states. These programs include incentives, like rebates for LED lights, efficient heating and cooling systems, or home insulation.
We found that energy efficiency appears to be a really low-cost way to reduce demand. We had residential, commercial, industrial, and low-income programs that all produced peak demand savings.
Peak demand is when electricity use and strain on the grid is highest. Reducing demand helps utilities avoid the need to use highly polluting backup power plants. And it helps them add more wind and solar. These power sources are more variable and not reliable enough to meet sudden surges in demand, so reducing peak power use helps utilities transition to renewables. Frick says most consumers improve efficiency to save money and make their homes more comfortable, not to support the grid. But
those are all great benefits to think about as you make yourself more comfortable.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 22nd, 2020. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Samantha Lau. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Tramel Gomes, Andrea Sears, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, covering art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Art Talk Bus Stop, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and performers. And at 11:30, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for an in-depth look at addiction care over the holidays.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's the most wonderful time of year, is the saying, However, it's also the most dangerous time in years because of the pandemic. KBOO's Annette Newell talks to an addiction medicine expert about why the holiday season is more challenging for those fighting relapse.
For people in addiction recovery, the holidays can be an especially challenging time. And this year with the COVID pandemic, isolation, unemployment, and ill health for a lot of people, certainly these are all weighing down very hard. Daniel Gallette is the Columbia Region Provider Leader for Ideal Option. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, tell us a little bit about what Ideal Option is and some of the services you offer.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ideal Option, we have about 75 outpatient addiction medicine clinics throughout 10 states in the United States. And we offer low-barrier medication-assisted treatment for a number of substance use disorders, primarily opiate use disorder, stimulant use disorder, alcohol use disorder, and also tobacco use disorder.
And here in the Pacific Northwest, where are you located?
So we're spread throughout the Pacific Northwest. We have a number of clinics in Washington. We have 5 clinics in Oregon as well. And then we're also in the Montana and Idaho region. But Washington is where our clinic was founded, and that's where we have the majority of our clinics.
How about in Portland? Do you have clinics in Portland?
We have a clinic located in Hillsboro, Oregon, and we also have 2 clinics just over the state line in Vancouver, Washington.
Okay, so a fair number of your patients are in the Portland area, Portland metro area.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the special dangers of relapse during the holidays?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and one we're seeing a lot in our clinical work. And I think it deserves a little bit of background to really understand why the holidays present such a challenge to those in recovery. Addiction is a very complex disease process, and I think a little background provides good context. So, substance use disorder, it's a chronic medical disease, which results from a really complex interplay of behavior, environmental, and biology. Unfortunately, the manifestations of substance use disorder are much more devastating than other chronic diseases like high blood pressure or diabetes, and it's typically characterized by compulsory substance use despite behavior that's self-destructive and can really negatively impact relationships with friends and family. So another piece when we're looking at the holidays in relation to recovery, it's really important to understand that chronic substance use results in measurable changes in multiple areas of the brain, including those areas involved in reward processing, impulse control, stress response. And those changes are what make affected individuals particularly sensitive to acute stressors in their environment, which can result in cravings and can precipitate a return to use. So the reason I give that background, the holidays can be stressful for anyone. They represent a particularly challenging time for individuals with a history of substance use disorder to maintain stable recovery because of that the changes that occur in their stress response. We have the data that supports from the CDC that supports that alcohol and drug-related deaths spike in December and January. So whether it's emotional stress from family conflict, financial strain, loneliness, grief, these tend to be magnified by the holidays and can contribute to increased cravings that may result in relapse because of those changes in the brain chemistry we see in folks with a history of opiate use disorder or any substance use disorder for that matter.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the signs for family members to watch out for then?
I think looking at primarily changes in emotion and behavior, I think those are the primary indicators someone in recovery may be struggling and may be at risk for return to use. So looking for things like self-isolation, avoidance of the recovery support system. You also want to be on the lookout for negative emotional changes. That can include things like depressed mood, increased anxiety, anger. I would also look for any sudden behavioral changes, major deviations from routine, whether that individual starts missing work, erratic sleeping, or eating habits as well. And one last thing to look for is an individual starting to romanticize prior drug use and express discontent or discomfort with their current recovery. Those are all indicators that a patient may be at higher risk for return to use.
Yeah, it's going to be harder to keep track of that kind of stuff now, though, because we are all in isolation, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point. The COVID pandemic has added another layer of difficulty for individuals with substance use disorder, particularly those in early recovery who may require more treatment resources and may rely more heavily on their support system. And COVID has limited access to really critical recovery resources like residential treatment, and it's also disrupted important recovery activities like 12-step meetings and intensive outpatient program classes, both of which are really important to allow folks with substance use disorder to feel connected to their recovery support.
So normally, do you see like a spike in people wanting to get some help during the holidays at your clinics?
I think so. And again, each individual's recovery journey is different, but I do think there's a sense that the holidays can, in some cases, represent an opportunity for change in heading into the new year by making efforts to stabilize in the recovery. But you know, on the same token, we also see a lot of individuals who have been very stable in the recovery start to struggle with things like increased cravings, using dreams, and these are a result of some of those stressors and the stress response we talked about. But yeah, certainly make no mistake, the holidays are an extraordinarily challenging time for those in recovery on the whole.
What advice would you give to people who are having these struggles right now?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to go back to the basics of successful recovery during the holidays. It really comes down to maintaining a structured, supportive recovery environment. So the best advice I could give would be to be aware of and avoid the people, places, and things that are associated with prior substance use. We know that these are very potent environmental cues and triggers for individuals with a history of substance use disorder and can certainly precipitate return to use. I think it's important to maintain structure and healthy routines, whether that's exercising regularly, eating well, sleeping well. Despite some of the challenges presented by COVID, I think it's really critical to continue reaching out to the support networks, whether that's participating in 12-step meetings, connecting with a sponsor, or just relying on folks in your life who are supportive of your recovery. I also recommend pursuing some sort of counseling support, whether it's mental health counseling, chemical dependency counseling, or in certain cases, grief counseling. If individuals don't have access to those types of support, I recommend journaling. It can help process anxiety and work through some of the complex emotions that arise during the holidays. And also planning ahead. You know, oftentimes holidays mean holiday parties, and sometimes that can expose folks in recovery to the people, places, and things that they have historically associated with using. So I think it's really important to have an escape plan. If at any point they begin to feel uncomfortable, whether it's from the stressful environment or stressful interactions with family, having that escape plan can be really important.
Okay, tell me, what do you mean by an escape plan?
Sure. So if you're in a situation where you're being exposed to environmental cues or triggers, these can cause increased cravings. And it's really important to make sure that individual gets out of that environment and is able to connect with someone in their support before that craving escalates to a point where it can precipitate a return to use.
I think a lot of people, not only are they isolated, but they're probably ashamed maybe in the situation of addiction, and yet it affects so many people. So what would your message be about that, about not being ashamed of trying to get some help?
Yeah. So I think addiction is still very misunderstood. And one of the main challenges which makes dealing with addiction so difficult is that a lot of the manifestations of the disease are antisocial behavior, lying, stealing. And I know that these are driven by the changes in the brain chemistry from addiction. But it can be very challenging as a family member or a friend of someone in addiction to be sympathetic or to be empathetic with that individual, what they're going through. So I think just reminding ourselves that this is a very complex brain disease. This is a chronic disease. It's not a reflection of someone's willpower or moral failing or personality. It's a brain chemistry disease. And I think having that understanding can help friends and family members and patients themselves reframe how they approach their addiction and hopefully lower some of the barriers to making sure that patient has really good support at home and also has access to treatment through clinics like ours.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add about this topic?
I just appreciate your willingness to shine some light on this really challenging disease and this particularly challenging time for folks who are struggling with substance use disorder. And my hope is that if we have more education and more opportunities to talk about addiction, we can help decrease some of the stigma and allow folks to feel more comfortable reaching out to those in the community and reaching out to support to help them get healthy.
And that was Daniel Gullett, the Columbia Region Provider Leader for Ideal Option. I am Annette Newell.
getting through the holidays during a global pandemic, and fighting an addiction. KBOO's Annette Newell talks to a survivor.
My name is J.D. Gear.
And where do you live, J.D.?
I live in Bend, Oregon.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about yourself and your life and what happened where you had an issue with addiction.
I've struggled with addiction since I was about 13 and 14 years old. I got into a car wreck, and after the car wreck, they prescribed me medication, and I took the medication and, like, kind of instantly fell in love with the instant satisfaction and the instant gratification I got from that, and the way it just kind of made everything else go away. And then I continued to struggle with addiction through my teenage years. Ended up going to prison when I was about 21. Got out, stayed clean for about 3 years, and then ended up kind of falling back into it. And then in 2018, I moved to Bend, Oregon. Still kind of continued to struggle with addiction. I was been homeless in Bend, Oregon for about 2 years. And then about in September, I found out I had a heart infection and I had issues with my heart. So I was hospitalized for 8 weeks. And kind of when I was in the hospital, like on my deathbed, pretty much, I decided I didn't want to live that life, and I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die an addict, so I decided to get help, and have been clean since.
Where did you get help at?
I got help through Best Care here in Bend. A couple of the recovery mentors from Best Care came and seen me while I was in the hospital, and they got me set up with Turning Points Recovery, and it's housing and treatment. And so now I'm currently in Turning Points, and I go to Ideal Options for my Suboxone treatment weekly, and so I do that, and I do Turning Points.
You described a treatment. What is the treatment you're talking about?
So the treatment I do is 5 days a week from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. I do different classes like CBT, which is cognitive behavior therapy. I do DBT, which is diversional behavior therapy. We do like mindfulness group where like we learn how to be mindful of ourselves and others. And we also do like relapse prevention groups, and we do MRT, which is a book where you go through and you have to do 16 steps that kind of mimic the steps of NA, but are slightly different, where we have to write out some of our stuff and some of our issues and then do like speeches in front of people about it to be able to pass to go on to the next step.
Tell me, you know, we're in the holiday season right now. Why is this such a tough time for those struggling with addiction and to defeat addiction? Why does this time of year present extra challenges?
For the holiday seasons, a lot of us have to deal with the wreckage of our past and the things that our addiction has brought for us, which is we lose a lot of family members, we lose a lot of trust. Me, myself, I don't have family, and a lot of people don't. A lot of people stray away from their families in this disease because some people just kind of shun people with addiction. Some people steal from their families, and so their families don't want them around. So for us, it's being alone on the holidays, being depressed, and just kind of feeling hopeless and that nobody cares because we don't really have anybody. So for me, it's really important to be in recovery and be around people this time of year because you learn that through recovery, you do have people. There's people that care. People that you never met before care about you. And if you put forth the effort to try and change your life, you'll see how quickly those people come into your life. And it's kind of a beautiful thing.
You know, that's so wonderful you were able to get help. But I'm wondering, because of the pandemic going on, so many people are in isolation. Is it going to be even more difficult to catch people before they fall through the cracks in this situation with the pandemic going on?
I mean, yes, it is going to be difficult to catch more people because of the pandemic, but there are also options available. As in, I go to treatment over Zoom. All my meetings are over video chat and stuff like that, and there's a lot of places that are doing treatment that way, but there's also a lot of places like inpatient where they're having to social distance, so inpatients kind of cutting their number of people they're allowed to have in half. which is making it like to where people are just falling through the cracks drastically because they can't have as much people in there. And I mean, it's kind of going to be hard just to build new rehabs to, you know, house these people. So until like the pandemic's over, it's just going to be really hard for everybody to get help because just everybody's having to cut their numbers in half.
Was it an opioid that you became addicted to?
I ended up becoming addicted to heroin.
Yeah, so that starts with opioid painkillers, yeah. Correct? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I've I've seen so many documentaries and read so much about this, and it's just, how common is it here in Oregon that people are getting hooked on, I should say, these painkillers?
It's more common here than anywhere I've ever lived. I grew up in Reno, Nevada, and Sacramento, California. I kind of bounced back between those two places. And you would think that those places are bigger and have more people that addiction would be more rampant, but it's not. I've seen more drug addiction here and more people getting hooked to it than I've seen anywhere in my whole life. And it's kind of crazy, to be honest.
What advice would you give to folks during the holiday season, during this COVID particular holiday season, about trying to stay clean?
The advice I would give people during this holiday season is just to for help. Even though there's the pandemic and there's places that are cutting their intake in half, there is places that are willing to help. And if you search for it, you will find it. It has to be one of those things where if you want it, you have to want it. And if you want it, you won't give up. You'll find where you need to go. And just to reach out. If you reach out to any doctor, any therapist, anybody that works in the medical field, anybody in like DHS, any of that, they will find you help. They know where to take you. And so it's just mainly reaching out and not giving up.
Yeah, and I've also been reading stats that people are drinking more too because they're home and they're isolated. Does that concern you?
It does concern me. I've never had a problem with alcohol myself, but I do see in a lot of cases where people that are addicted to drugs start substituting one for another and figure, hey, well, I'm not doing drugs, so now I can drink. And drinking is kind of the lesser of two evils, but at the same time, drinking ends up as an addiction that's going to bring the same pain as anything else. If you do it to an extent, you're going to end up homeless, you're going to end up jobless, and it's going to be the same exact pattern as when you were using drugs. And a lot of people don't realize that because it's legal, and you know, and then they go down that path, and then next thing they know, they're back in that whirlwind. And so that really scares me too, because it's so accessible, it's so available, and I from what I've seen in Oregon, is drinking's kind of big. Like they have like the growlers, and people go out to like beer fest, and like drinking's really big out here. And so it's a hard one for people. It really is.
Yeah. Tell me how your life is different today let's give us just a contrast and compare how your life is now versus when you were using.
My life is different today by one where I'm taking care of myself. I get up, I get the things I need to get done. I take care of my life. I go to work. I am responsible in the way of where I'm planning out the future of my life and doing things for like the betterment of my future, to whereas I'm kind of, before I was stuck in this like just stagnant area where I was constantly just going down and down and down and down and doing nothing really to move forward. It was bad decision after bad decision after bad decision that led me to homelessness. And then I got to that place, hopelessness, where I wasn't looking for help. I didn't care about getting help, and I was just okay with that I was homeless. I was okay that I was going to drive a drug addict, whereas today I don't want that for myself. I realized that just because I had a rocky past doesn't mean I have to have a rocky future, and I can change who I am and have a better future for myself, and I'm not stuck where I'm at.
Wow. Yeah. And how long did it take you to get to that point?
It took a couple years of trying. I ended up going to Ideal Options to get help through Suboxone. And my first 3 months with them, I was still using every week. I was relapsing constantly. So after about 3 months of going to my Suboxone treatment and just keeping trying and trying and trying, I finally stayed clean. And so it took me about 3 months of trying before I actually stayed clean.
Do you mind my asking how old you are?
I'm 29 years old.
Okay. And when did you first start taking the painkiller that you became addicted to?
At 13 years old.
Wow. And how long had you been using it when you knew you had a problem?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you remember how long it was before you became addicted?
I probably within a couple of years, I realized I had a problem.
What was the telltale sign that made you realize, okay, this is a problem?
Where that's all I was doing. I was waking up every day thinking how I was going to get my next high, how I was going to get money to buy pills. I started stealing from my family, stealing from others, stopped going to school, stopped working, and my whole life was centered around drugs and how I was going to get and use drugs. And that's when I realized I had an issue.
And once you did that, was it tough to tell those around you, your loved ones, your family, that you were going through this?
Absolutely, because a lot of my family couldn't tell, and a lot of my family was surprised. I kind of always had the notion of my family always thought I was the good kid, and that I was the kid that was responsible, and I was the kid that was the one that was going to make it. But it was kind of all of a facade that I put up to my family so they wouldn't know. So it was kind of hard for them to believe that I was doing that. And, you know, at first they kind of didn't even believe my problem was that bad, and kind of, you know, pushed it to the side, and, you know, it was kind of taboo at that time for anybody in my family to have a drug addiction. So it was kind of like they kind of didn't believe me at first, but then over the years when they seen the wreckage that I started causing, then they kind of realized I had the issue I had and kind of separated themselves from me because I was stealing from them and stuff like that. Now I still really don't have that close of a relationship with my family because of the wreckage of my past.
Are you trying to improve your current relationship with your family?
Absolutely. I absolutely am, and I'm just taking it slow because I'm trying to realize that it's going to take more than a few months or a year to fix the wreckage of 10, 15 years. And so I'm just kind of taking it slow, and, you know, it's going to take some time before they trust me. But, you know, I hold on to the hope that eventually that will happen, and I'll get to go spend Christmas with them, and I'll get to go see them and stuff like that, because as of now, they don't invite me to Christmas, stuff like that, because they don't trust me.
Congratulations on your recovery, though, and on the journey you've had, because it sounds like you have really survived a lot of obstacles.
Yes, ma'am.
What advice would you... I mean, you were young when this happened. You were only 13 when you first started using this painkiller you became addicted to. What advice would you give to parents and to family members and loved ones about what they should watch out for?
They should start watching out for, one, is sneaky behavior. If your kid starts being sneaky and hiding things from you when usually your child's not that way, that's something to look into. When your child starts acting different, if they start isolating a lot, staying in their rooms a lot when they're usually not like that, stop hanging out with the friends they used to hang out with, that's a big telltale sign. If your kid stops hanging out with like the usual kids they hang out with and kind of start hanging out with different people that they really don't know, that's a big telltale sign as well, because a lot of kids don't have friends that use to start out with, and then they find those friends and stop hanging out with the old friends. Also, depression. If your kid starts getting like highs and lows of depression or anger, that's another sign to look out for, because in coming down and when you don't have those things, that you act out. And you act out in anger and you're depressed and stuff like that. And so those are things to look out for too, is just the kid's all around attitude and stuff like that.
And looking ahead to, we're going into a new year soon, what are some of your hopes and plans for the future?
Some of my hopes and plans for the future are to eventually get my own place, get out of sober living, get my own place, and get a steady job, and just be able to go to work steadily and pay bills steadily and do that kind of stuff that I never did, where I was just a productive member of society. I want to become a productive member of society instead of a member of society that's just sucking from the system with jail, welfare, food stamps, and all that stuff. And I want to start taking care of myself and, just like I said, become a productive member of society.
Are you studying anything, or do you have any idea of what kind of profession you'd like to go into?
I cook. I've cooked for about 10 years, and that's a good job for me. It keeps me busy, keeps my mind going, and it keeps me in the moment.
Wonderful. Okay, is there anything else I haven't asked you that you think people should know on this topic?
Just to always remember to help somebody and support somebody. It may be hard to put the things behind you that they've done to you and forgive somebody, but the biggest thing, addicts need your help. And when you show that addict that there is some sort of hope and some sort of help for them, a lot will change to go into that and get help. A lot of people, a lot of addicts just want support. So as hard as it may be, I just would tell everybody to give them support and try and get them help as best as you can.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so very much. I really appreciate you sharing the story with me, and I wish you the best of luck and happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Have a happy New Year.
Okay. And that was Josh and his story. I'm Annette Newell.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be part of this year's Give Guide by Willamette Week. What's Give Guide? It's the fast and easy way to do end-of-year giving to any of the 174 nonprofits chosen for this year's Give Guide.